This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Author Philip Gerard spent years writing about the Civil War, but he doesn't focus on the exalted generals and all the very, very famous battles, although those are part of his story. Instead, his writings recount the lives of unexpected and often unsung players. The escaped slave turned Union recruiter, the farm wife who hosted surrender talks, and the society hostess who snuck coded messages to the Confederates. These are just a few of the stories gathered in the new book, The Last Battleground, The Civil War Comes to North Carolina. Philip Gerard is a professor of creative writing at UNC Wilmington and joins us from partner station WHQR. Philip Gerard, welcome.
Hey, my pleasure to be here.
Give us a snapshot of North Carolina at the time of the Civil War, because we often hear that North Carolina was really a reluctant participant in the war, reluctant to join the Confederacy. Who was for it? Who was against it at the time of the Civil War?
Well, North Carolina was a very divided state. We just heard a little bit about that today, but it was about 50-50 among the white population, Unionist versus Confederate, and of course about 330,000 of its citizens were actually enslaved blacks, and they had no say in the matter. So North Carolina becomes a great lens through which to look at the entire war, its position as both a home front and a battleground. And in the last 4 months or so of the war, pretty much everything that matters in the East happens in North Carolina.
That's fascinating. Not the early part, but you talk about the fact that among the white population, a 50-50 divide, and yet once the war begins, of the 150,000 or so white men you report in North Carolina, 125,000 sign up, or at least find themselves involved one way or another.
Many, I think, found themselves involved reluctantly because, of course, one of the very first things the Confederate government did was to have a conscription law. And there was a lot of resentment about that because of the rule that let slave owners go not have to report for duty if they had a certain number of slaves. And so what they ended up doing was dividing their large slaveholding, you know, so that all the sons could claim a certain number and stay out of the war. And this was a bone of contention, the old rich man's war, poor man's fight that Governor Vance was talking about.
Yeah. So now let's talk about the way you tell your story in The Last Battlefield. You outlined three ways that you wanted to tell stories of the Civil War differently than some of the conventional approaches to narrative. What was your mission for this?
Sure. I'm not a trained historian. I'm a writer. And my idea was to write about the war with only the knowledge of the time. That is not the historian's kind of settled view, knowing all the facts and how things turned out. I wanted to capture that really essential and terrible suspense that these people endured. They didn't really know how this would turn out. And so these are written in the present tense to keep a sense of really immediate action happening. And everything is connected to either North Carolina or North Carolinians, and they ranged far and wide in the war, and they had important roles in pretty much every battle that happened outside of that. And so that I was really reporting the war as if it were happening, doing what Teddy Roosevelt said in his address to the American Historical Association, you know, trying to make the past present so that it didn't seem like a settled business. It was real stories happening in real time with an unknown outcome.
And there are some fascinating stories. I want to get into a few of them here, but I want to get also kind of a general sketch of what the soldier might have carried. And you talk about the personal effects. I mean, the fact is you had to pretty much arm and clothe and feed yourself if you were a Confederate soldier. Talk about what a North Carolina Confederate soldier might have brought to the battlefield with him.
Sure. My metaphor in the chapter I write about that is that the war is essentially a job, and they're taking their tools to the work site along with all their provisions. And so they're typically marching in fairly, by the first or second summer of the war, their uniforms are getting pretty raggedy, but they're generally going to be homespun unless you're an officer. You're going to have shoes that eventually wear out, and so you might be barefoot, or you might have your shoes around your neck by the laces and put them on only when you're going into battle. You're carrying a big, heavy musket. You're carrying a powder box for that musket, cartridges. You're carrying lead bullets. You have a cotton haversack that fits over your shoulder, and in it you have, if you're lucky, some rations. If you're not lucky, you have what you pick up along the way. You have some kind of a hat, and it varied widely. It could be a sort of forage cap, which is a very cheap cap to make based on the French model, or a slouch hat, which is a kind of a country hat with a wide brim. And they would have carried their other things into battle. Some of them had their own knives, pen knives or bowie knives. They had an assortment of other kinds of firearms that they might take from home. They carried in their pockets chewing tobacco, you know, twisted chewing tobacco. maybe the most precious thing they carried was the pictures of their loved ones, if they were lucky enough to have one. These might be in a simple frame, or they might be in no frame at all. And they might also carry letters from home that would maybe carry their own weight of grief if they hear from someone back home that a loved one has died or is ill, or as many of the soldiers began to hear from their wives, they were starving, they were having trouble, and they were exhorting their men to come home from the Virginia battlefields and come back to their farms. So they carried a weight, and then the weight becomes metaphorical. They're carrying the weight of their own mortality, the weight of the loss of their friends, and the weight of waiting for tomorrow's battle and whether they're going to be able to survive it or not.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to hear what weight they would continue to carry, even though it did, weigh them down. The letters and the pictures stayed. It was the food that was jettisoned or eaten quickly.
Well, they often were issued 3 days rations of some kind before March, and pretty soon it became the custom simply to wolf everything down on the first day to make sure you got it while it was fresh enough to eat, and then pick up along the way whatever you could. And one of the problems that the Confederates ran into throughout the war, every time they had a victory and they raided a Yankee camp, U.S. Army camp, they would stop because it had food, it had clothes, it had ponchos, it had tent supplies, and they would loot the camp first and stop the battle. And this became a kind of frustration for many of the generals.
Couldn't keep the war moving. One of the interesting tools that I read about in your book and was not aware of was the Confederate bayonet, different than the Union bayonet, a fascinating weapon. And talk more about that. It was an interesting passage.
The socket bayonet, you sort of fit it over the end of the rifled musket and twist, and it's on there good. And, we have statistics that very rarely did people actually stab each other with it in battle. It had a triangular blade so that when you did stick somebody, it was a wound that was almost impossible to suture closed. So it was a very ugly kind of instrument. But the men most often seemed to use it as a candle holder. It was perfect. You could stick the sharp end into the ground, put the candle in the rounded socket, and thereby have some light to read or write a letter home to your loved one or read a letter that you just got from your loved one.
Was this because the reluctance to use this? I mean, certainly there was a lot of hand-to-hand combat. We know things were much closer than we know in battle today. And we've heard about this, too, in terms of firing weapons, that people who are not really trained to kill and are conscripted into a military cause find it very difficult to kill. We found this with kill rates and actual the ability to hit another soldier with a bullet. People were aiming over their heads. Is this the same with the bayonet? I just can't bear to use this thing?
I think that, but it might even be truer that so much of the killing went on long distance. Mm. Fort Fisher here in near Wilmington is a great example. In the beginning of 1865, when it finally is attacked for the second time and falls, you have this massive bombardment. I think the first bombardment of Fort Fisher on Christmas Eve of 1864 was the largest bombardment from sea in history up to that time. And the second was almost as bad. And so you had people just blown apart. You didn't really have a lot of hand-to-hand until later when the troops stormed the walls, and then you did. But at that close quarters, bayonets are harder to use. A bayonet is, 5 feet away from your opponent when you're using it or so. And I think... Yeah. In the melee, it was more clubbing and fists and, that kind of thing. But the rifled musket was killing people from hundreds of yards away and canister shot from cannon. So by the time you got to use the bayonet, I think the numbers are going to be fairly small.
I think they were looking at Gettysburg. I think that's where I remembered hearing that they took a look at the number of rounds fired, and they were at relatively close range. And they said, well, how can they possibly miss so often? And that's when they realized there were actually many, many of the soldiers were firing over people's heads, even though they were in close quarters. But I'm sure it varied from place to place. I want to talk about some of the standout characters in the book. Let us start with Rose O'Neill Greenhow.
Oh, Rose O'Neill Greenhow is a society hostess in Washington, living only a few blocks from the White House. And her sympathies are decidedly Southern and secessionist. And when the war breaks out, she's entertaining in these wonderful dinner parties. And it's a coveted invitation if you get it. She's serving the best wine and brandy and food and the best conversation. And she herself is something of a beauty. Very long hair, they said, down to her calves. And she would chat up these guys, get them drunk, and a lot of the guys were Union officers. And some of them she would take to her bedroom, reportedly. And so she ends up with the plans for the Union Army's maneuvers going into the Battle of Bull Run, gets those to the Confederate lines, and really has a decided outcome, effect on the outcome of the battle, and then continues to do that even after the, in a comical scene, Pinkerton, Alan Pinkerton, the famous detective who worked for Lincoln and the Secret Service, is in the rain, being hoisted onto the shoulders of two of his men, peering in her window as she's sitting there making love to a Union officer, and he's handing her the map that's the incriminating evidence. And they finally arrest her, imprison her first in her own home and then later in the Capitol prison, but they can't quite stop her. She's still sending out coded messages all the way down south. And eventually, because they can't do anything with her, they can't decide whether to charge her. They free her back to Virginia, but her cover is blown. She can no longer be a spy. So she goes abroad as an emissary for Jefferson Davis, publishes a book in England about her trials and tribulations in prison, and is heading back on a blockade runner called the Condor. And it's a very fast Scottish-built blockade runner. And she has 400 gold sovereigns, the royalties from her book, which she intends to donate to the Confederate Veterans Relief Organization. And off Fort Fisher on a rainy night in October, October 1st, I think it was, of that year, the skipper veers to avoid what he thinks is a warship, and it turns out it's just a hulk that's stuck on a sandbar. He runs aground. She is so fearful of being captured and put back in prison that she demands to be put out in a boat. So she is put out in a boat with four other people. The boat immediately capsizes, and they're rescued, but she's weighed down by her gold and drowns, washes ashore, and is discovered by, I think, what is usually called the shortest man with the longest name in the Confederate Army, a guy named, he's 3'11", his name is J.J. Prosper for me, D. Dr. Devowell Connor.
Man, you as a creative writer must have loved that story. To be able to verify those details as a creative writer, that had to be your great moment.
Well, I was on the shoulders of some great historians who helped me. Dr. Chris Fonville is a great historian down here, and he verified the name for me.
Yeah, and you couldn't even come up. Was it a little embarrassing to think to yourself, gee, you know what, I'm not sure I could have written that story. If I wanted to come up with a complete fabrication as a screenplay, that story would never have occurred to me. Philip Joy.
Well, so many of the stories are that way, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about another a really important character, Abraham Galloway, whose story is very important and I think needs to be told more often. Tell us about Abraham Galloway.
Sure. Abraham Galloway is born a slave to a white father and a black mother here on the Cape Fear. He escapes in 1857 on a turpentine schooner, ends up in Philadelphia, becomes really active in the abolitionist movement and the Underground Railroad. He ranges as far as Canada. And when war breaks out, he makes his way back to North Carolina to occupy New Bern, which has been occupied by the Union forces since 1862, sets up shop there as like the major fixer. He becomes a spy. He's going back and forth. He actually rescues his own mother from behind Confederate lines and gets her to Philadelphia. And he's working with about 59 or 60 other African-Americans who are acting as scouts and guides and spies, and then is called upon when General Augustus Wilde wants to raise what are called the U.S. Colored Troops, USCT. He actually negotiates with the U.S. Army. He will not allow the men to enlist unless they meet a set of demands. They have to have equal pay. They have to have promises that their loved ones at the Freedmen's Colony will be cared for and provided for while they're gone. They bargain for education for their children while they're gone so that once the war is over, they'll have prospects. And the most important thing they bargain for is that in the event they're captured, that they be treated as prisoners of war. And in the event the Confederate government maintained till the end a policy that if they captured black troops in battle, they would be taken to slavery. And then if you were a white commander of black troops captured in battle, you would be summarily executed. And in the event, at a number of battles, the Crater, Fort Pillow, and elsewhere, when black troops were captured and disarmed, they were then executed, often en masse. So black troops had a difficult time of it, but Galloway was there right at the center. After the war, he becomes a major figure. He goes to the legislature. He is active in women's rights. He moves back to Wilmington, and then I think he's only about 33 years old, and he dies unexpectedly of a fever, and 6,000 people accompany his casket to the graveyard. So he made an impact.
Well, he did make an impact. I mean, a couple of things to point out here. He recruited a great number of recruits, black recruits, into the Union Army, right? That's number one.
Sure, three whole regiments, and they did well for themselves, and eventually something like 5,000 or so of the blacks, most had been formerly enslaved, enlisted in the Union Army and fought for North Carolina.
So that underscores the role that African Americans played in their own freedom, and that's something that I think doesn't get played up enough. And Abraham Galloway, of course, played a key role in that. They were participants, and I think the other thing is that he was able to negotiate. He wasn't just like, oh, well, thank you, sir, for giving me this opportunity. He's like, oh, by the way, you want me to do this? Here's what we have to get, right?
He was apparently a very imposing fellow. He would walk around very prominently displaying a big horse pistol in his belt, and he confided to almost no one. He was a very secretive kind of man, but everybody listened to him, and he had great sway in that community, and the Union Army depended on him absolutely to get those three regiments.
So let's talk about Nancy Bennett now and how the war ends, because it wasn't quite sure. There was not a great deal of certainty at Appomattox that things were really over, but finally at Bennett Place, things had ended. Tell us about Nancy Bennett.
Sure. We're all taught that the war ended when Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, but in fact, it keeps on going on. There are 90,000 combat troops in the Confederate Army that are in the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida. And when Sherman makes his famous march, the one he thought was the hard one, 450 miles, within about 90 days, he brings 60,000 troops, fights two major battles and a cavalry action, captures the arsenal at Fayetteville and destroys it, captures Goldsboro, the great railroad hub, and eventually takes the surrender of General Joseph Johnston of 90,000 troops. And he does this at the modest little farmstead of James and Nancy Bennett on the Hillsborough Road near Durham. And they kind of become a poster family for the war. They had just got into the yeoman farmer class, which meant they were finally making a go of it. And they owned their own land. They owned their own farm. They weren't sharecroppers anymore. They were prominent in the community. But the war destroys them. It takes their sons. It takes their son-in-law. It destroys their economic well-being. And they had that in common with the entire state. I mean, the state was just devastated economically by the war. Food was hard to come by. So you can imagine when these two generals and their entourage show up unannounced at their door and say, oh, by the way, can we borrow your parlor? And
to negotiate an end of the Civil War.
And you could have I can only imagine what my mother might have said to them. But instead, Nancy Bennett very graciously invites them in, takes the family out to, the survivors out to the cookhouse, and brings the generals a pitcher of cold buttermilk and lets them to their work. And I find that image tremendously reassuring in one respect, but also just heartbreakingly sad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an incredible story. The asterisk here is that there was a pause in those negotiations because of the assassination of President Lincoln, which meant something like 40,000 troops, maybe 80,000, 40,000 on each side, who had all come for the surrender, right? I mean, you got Confederate soldiers to lay down their weapons, the Union soldiers there to enforce all that, milling about, and in the process smoking something called bright leaf tobacco, which they then went home and mail ordered, and pretty soon the city of Durham would go from a crossroads to the home of the largest exporter in the world. Who knew?
Exactly. I mean, it takes about 9 days because the generals essentially have to disobey their governments. Johnston's orders are to keep on fighting, send the infantry to the mountains for a guerrilla war. At this point, Jefferson Davis is fairly unhinged, and Johnston is appalled by the order and decides that he's not really going to follow it. He's going to surrender. And on his part, Sherman wants this war over as well. He has orders basically to destroy Johnston's army. They sign a surrender, and then it's both governments say, no, you can't do this. So Grant comes down from Washington on the orders of the War Department basically to fire Sherman. And he doesn't do that either. He disobeys and tells him, give them the same terms I gave Lee at Appomattox. And then they work out a kind of a codicil to the surrender that says, we will give you, some transportation and food and what have you for your troops so that there's not the mayhem that followed the surrender in Virginia. And they conclude, the greatest war on the continent. And the thing that I love best about that story is that Joseph Johnston and William T. Sherman, who had never met, they'd been enemies in arms for years, become fast friends after that and remain friends for life.
What was in the buttermilk? Philip
yes,
Girard.
I want some of it.
Philip Girard. By the way, Grant was appalled to find out that that's what they were drinking. Philip
well,
Girard.
Sherman had a flask of whiskey as well.
There we go. Philip Girard, author of The Last Battleground, The Civil War Comes to North Carolina, professor of creative writing at UNC Wilmington as well. Going to talk about the book Thursday at 6 o'clock, Cumberland County Library in Fayetteville, then Sunday, 2 o'clock, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, and then going to be at Cameron Art Museum in Wilmington on April 7th. We've got it at our website, Stay stateofthings.org. If you missed it, Philip, what a pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, a UNC scholar shares tales of being an angst-ridden kid in a new one-person show. Stay tuned.